struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, what a beautiful day it is here in Midtown New York City. Gorgeous day. Perfect opening day for the New York Mets. The Mets are red hot, man. Woo! And the Yankees are not. Just heard a great story from my producer and program director, Jesse. He told me that he got busted. This is totally a Ferris Bueller's Day Is Off busted story. That he went senior in high school to the opening day for the Mets. And he got shot on TV. And his father saw him. What are the odds of that? That's a great story. A story that he can tell his kids and his grandchildren. I love it. The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for joining me today and every Thursday. So much to get to today. And make sure you stay with us for the whole hour because Gary Null will precede me. We're going to meet Michelle Spritz. She's a voiceover artist, philanthropist, disability advocate, and a great person. Her work is just reaching millions of people nationally and worldwide. We're going to hear from a member from the NRDC, National Resources Defense Council, Lauren Urbaniak. She's going to talk about the rollbacks. The Trump Organization is intent on rolling back energy efficiency standards for common light bulbs and to change how it sets standards. Really against that. I mean, we've made some great headway with high efficiency bulbs in the last 7 years. Remember how expensive they were? When you go to Home Depot, you'd have like car sticker shock like 5-7 years ago. Now you have LED bulbs. You replace those CFL bulbs. CFL bulbs were like, it's like a Martian came down, you know, like 10-15 years ago and said, okay, use these. They look very strange, but they'll save you lots of money and are good for the environment. Of course, we switched over, but now it's nice to have LED bulbs that look much more like traditional bulbs. And I believe, I have to ask Lauren about this, but I believe the traditional bulbs are no longer produced in the United States. I think that last factory, which I think was a, the name of the manufacturer is on the tip of my tongue, closed its plant maybe about a year ago. GE, General Electric, I think it was. Yeah, possibly. So Michelle Spitz on the way, woman of her word. She's in a car being shuttled across Midtown, and Lauren Urbaniak from NRDC momentarily near the end of the show. Britney Spears is taking some time off because apparently her father is undergoing a lot of health treatments and it's weighing on her. So it appears that reports that she's checked into a facility. I hate to say the word institution because it's so stereotypical. And of course, when I go to speak to an event like this coming Sunday on mental health, we try to chip away at the stereotypes, but good for Britney for getting help. Apparently, she's having some depression issues, panic attacks, anxiety. I'm not sure. But of course, she's handling it in a much better position and set of circumstances than she did back in, oh, I think that was probably 2008 when she had her breakdown. Though, so the Mueller report. Wow, where do we start? Okay, A.G. Bell. 4,000 pages, you know, just a couple pages in his summary. And now more information is coming out from the people who actually were part of the investigation team saying, no, this is not right. What is being expressed is not even appropriate in a summary sentence. So we need to have this whole thing. Yes, there can be redactions for the stuff that should not be privileged for the general public, but it needs to be released. Obviously, I'm sure you're in agreement with this, and if you're not, I'd love to hear why you're not. 888-874-4888. This is information 2 years, almost 2 years in the making, and I believe it's certainly vital for the national security, for the office of the United States president to find out exactly what took place, collusion, et cetera. And I think that's vital. And I hope it's just going to make it's just a matter of time before this happens. And I really hope this does take place. So Mick Jagger going to be getting open heart surgery. A lot of dejected fans. Of course, a lot of fans are worried about him. First of all, you know, when you are that old and you go for any massive surgery, there is a risk factor. I'm sure Mick is probably seeing some very, very good doctors, and probably, I mean, besides, you know, we make fun of him for his facial aging, et cetera, but the guy is in incredible shape. He's far from obese. He's fit. He's active. He still runs around that stage like a maniac, which is great. We love it. But it made me think about this because I bought some tickets for Phil Collins. Now, my son is a drummer. He's 9 years old, and he's got some good chops. He's playing with he's playing at a fairly advanced facility for lessons, and they're sticking him with 15-year-olds, a band of 15-year-olds, and he's 6 years younger than them. And he really gets it. So I figured this would be a great treat. My wife and I said, well, take him to a Phil Collins show. Fast forward, bought the tickets. The show's this October. And, of course, just to remind you, Phil Collins is not only a singer, he is a drummer. In the Air Tonight, a lot of the songs, excuse me, he's actually played, like Face Values, that album. He plays on a kit the entire album. Now, years past, he has multiple drum kits on stage, and he plays, excuse me, throughout intermittently the show, and or has another percussionist and or another drummer. Really, really fascinating stuff. So last night, I'm saying to myself, you know what? I just want to check to make sure. And look how exciting this tour. I think the name of the tour is I'm Not Dead Yet, Still. Something like that. Because he wrote a book. And his biography illustrates how he had three failed marriages. I think three, four, or five kids. And he was on a precipice of suicide. He was a serious drinker. And actually, I think... you know, I'd really like to buy the book because it's reminiscent of Bruce Springsteen's book, and I will get on it, and I would actually love them to be on the show. We'll reach out to him. But it made me think of Bruce Springsteen and his efforts to certainly make it and succeed through all the grit and grind to make it in the industry. So anyway, so I'm looking through his material and I'm seeing some old videos of him on stage live. I'm like, oh man, this is going to be electric, incredible, phenomenal show. And then I see some videos from the last 2 years and I'm thinking about how much money I spent on those tickets. And I'm thinking about, can I dump these tickets? And I'm going to be dumping these tickets. And here's why. Because Phil does not play the drums anymore. Phil has chronic pain in one or both of his wrists most days. Phil is not only not stage center, but he's usually off to the side, seated. Yeah. And if that wasn't bad enough, Phil does not really sound like Phil Collins. His voice is kind of pinched. And, yeah, so I'm playing these clips. I'm looking at my wife. She's looking at me and going like, oh, man, I don't know about this. She's like, you know what? He's not going to know the difference, meaning my son. And I'm like, yes, you're right. But that means I'm going to have to sit through this for 90 minutes or more. And not only that, but we paid a boatload of money for these tickets. And thirdly, you know what? I'm thinking actually I had an epiphany this morning. I should just find a great Genesis or Phil Collins or both cover band. And my son would be psyched for that. So I'm having major, major second thoughts about this. I think I'm going to go that route. I feel bad for the guy. You know, he's actually not that old. Think about his counterparts. Rod Stewart, Mick Jagger, all these other incredible rockers that are out there on the road doing their thing. He's only 67, Phil Collins. I had to say hello to my guest. We'll get to you shortly. I like the jacket. I don't think you're going to leave with that. So Phil Collins, I feel bad for him because he's an aging rocker. He loves what he does. And apparently he was cajoled into returning to the stage because everywhere he would go, he would say, you know, people come up to him, we miss you. Come back to the stage. Give us what you've gave us for years. Do you remember the first Live Aid concert? Now, you may not recall back then this actually happening, but he played on two continents. He played at both Live Aids, not simultaneously, of course. He played in London, jumped on a helicopter, I think went to Heathrow, flew over to Philadelphia, landed, and I think either took another helicopter or was shuttled to the following Live Aid where he played. How cool is that? I got ultimate mad respect for the guy. But that doesn't mean I should spend a fortune on his tickets if he doesn't sound good and perform on the drums. Okay, I don't want to feel like I'm beating up on Phil Collins anymore. As I started to say, it is opening day for the Mets, and the Mets are on fire. And whether you're a baseball fan or not, but it's kind of the rite of passage for spring, which is always kind of nice. And I always like to look at the buds on trees. Of course, the pretty women walking around New York City, of course, catches my eyes. But the buds on the trees also catch my eye because it's just amazing how nature operates, isn't it? When you see just a barren branch, nothing but stick, and all of a sudden, a minuscule little round bulb of some sort, and it looks like it's not going to do anything. And all of a sudden, boom, it bursts open with a minuscule leaf, which turns into whatever size tree or type of tree variety it is. And every spring, I take so much appreciation and stock in that, and I find it to be so, so fascinating. And I share that with my kids, and they're not sick of it yet. So that's a good thing. So a lot of things have passed. Budgets, approvals, votes in Albany, New York City congestion pricing. So for our friends who are not in the tri-state area, nationally and or abroad, what they're trying to do is cut down on the amount of vehicles. The amount of time it's taken, they've done a lot of traffic studies in the last few years to cross Midtown, the heart of New York City, to get north and south in New York City has been growing and growing. And there's no answer in sight except for what they think congestion pricing will do. So in short, they do not have all the answers. They pass this, which is kind of a, and I want to footnote this by saying I'm for congestion pricing. If it's expedited well, the concept works, but the plan is not on paper. They don't have the pricing yet. They don't exactly know where the confines will be in Midtown. They don't have all very vital aspects of this congestion pricing plan figured out. So in true political fashion, it's like, okay, let's put the cart before the horse type of scenario. And that's what's happening here. So I think it's going to happen within the next 12 to 15, 16 months. All the kinks will be worked out. So basically, it's going to be like Easy Pass. You have a transponder on your windshield, and it's going to cost you a certain fee. Now, if you're a delivery service, a truck driver, it's going to be, I think they said something where from $20 to $25. Now, you may say to yourself, okay, for the cost of business, it's a write-off. It's not terrible. But keep in mind, that's when you're on the island of Manhattan. How do you get to the island of Manhattan? A bridge or tunnel. Now, that's going to cost, depending on the axle, how many physical axles they have, wheels on this particular vehicle, can cost them upwards to $20, $30, $40 just to roll onto the island of Manhattan. Now, your clients, your stores, all the people you're servicing are in Midtown. Tack on another $25, $30, maybe $40 to roll into Midtown. So you're looking at the upwards of $75, $100 per day. And this could be a vehicle that has to roll out of Manhattan several times if there are warehouses nearby. So a minimum of maybe $75 to $100 a day. That can really add up for a small business owner. So there's a lot of kinks to be worked out. Again, I'm for it because there's if you stand at a given crosswalk in New York City when you're waiting to have a green light to change so you can cross softly, safely, look at the amount of cars that have one person in it, solo drivers. And I get it. You know, there's Uber drivers out there, Lyft, et cetera. And that's a better way to go because Lyft actually is more of a ride sharing. And I think Uber has jumped on board as well with that. But yes, there's a lot of vehicles we can cut down on. But the reality is they're doing this. All this money has been earmarked. The future money from congestion pricing will be for the laughingstock of New York City, the MTA, Metropolitan Transit Authority. Now, if they don't need to be flushed out, total overhaul, then nothing in this world does. I think this is a huge Band-Aid effort. I think it should have been taken apart piece by piece, person by person, position by position, and retweaked, rebuilt, reconstructed. And then, you know what? Let's work with the congestion pricing then. Accountability. There must be accountability assigned for this because this is just outlandish. In a city where, you know, of course, this city operates and we're the capital of the world. Unofficially, I try to explain that to my kids, but we are. And there's only, I believe, one other city. I could be wrong on this, so I don't want to misspeak, but I could be wrong. I believe there's one other city, and it could be London, that's doing this. But as I'm saying this, it sounds wrong, so I could be mistaken on that. Anyway, so stand by for news on that, for progress, because it's something that's going to be unavoidable. I do not drive into the city during the week. I avoided all measures. If I do, I do not come into Midtown. I'll take the Holland Tunnel. That services the southern part of the island of Manhattan. And that will not be incurred for congestion pricing for Midtown. but there's ways around it. Of course, mass transportation. The biggest thing that we have right now going against us is Donald Trump had issues with our former governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. So the tunnel that we need, the additional conduit from New Jersey into Manhattan was put the kibosh on. We need the federal funds. I forget the upwards of high millions. I don't know. 800 million, 900 million. It's an incredible number. But now, of course, with Donald Trump, you think he would take care of his home state. He's from the island or Brooklyn, I forget, or Queens. He would take care of this and funnel some federal funds our way because this is something that possibly could have alleviated the whole congestion pricing consideration and or thing that's going to be implemented. And one more thing, a footnote, is that I'm going to get someone in here for Transportation Alternatives. It's a great organization based in New York City that does just that, does studies, does focus groups, does research, redesign work, etc. I'm going to find out more about the congestion pricing and get their take on this and all the work that's been done and it's working on in the surrounding areas. And also the toll increases. I didn't get to that, but there's toll increases on many of the bridges and tunnels that just went into effect the other day. So that's wreaking havoc. So one more thing about New York City that got passed, and I'm really happy about this. About single-use plastic bags that will be banned. Of course, I don't know who the person was said, yeah, let's create these plastic bags, and they will take off like wildfire, because they did. And this has been going on for 20 years now? I mean, where are you? Stores are making a change, and hopefully you see that wherever you live. Our European listeners certainly never even had to go there, because they went with reusable bags, cloth bags, etc. We're certainly seeing a change in my local supermarket. I see maybe, I'm going to make up a number, 10, 15% of people bringing their own sustainable bags, which is great. But in New York City, in major metropolitan cities, I can't even imagine the waste, the amount of bags that are not recycled. And then here's the whole thing. I'm sorry, I'm going on a major tangent here. I want to get to my Michelle Spitz guest. But the fact is that we can't even sell our recyclables anymore to other countries. They're saying no, they won't take it. So it's just a lose-lose situation. And I just imagine what's going to happen now with our Chinese food delivery drivers. They're on bicycles. They're ubiquitous. They're everywhere in New York City. And they have their handles on their plastic bags over their bicycle handles. I don't know what they're going to do. I guess they're going to have to get by with sustainable bags and actually give us a paper bag. And last but not least, I just had a great conversation with Raquel. Raquel is the welcoming face and smile and great personality of the Progressive Radio Network in the lobby. She's the first person you experience when you get off the elevator, as Michelle Spitz just did. And I'm sure she was most gracious to Michelle, but she was not just gracious to me. She was very candid. I said to her this morning, hey, and she, first of all, I say she's got it going on. Very classy, elegant, very sophisticated and sweet and professional. I said to her, and I had this thought this morning when I opened my closet door, I just didn't feel like wearing a real dress shirt today, so I wore a light flannel shirt. And to my knowledge, to my, you know, couture, deep, vast culture understanding, that it is still very much in fashion. So I said to her, hey, Raquel, when do you think flannel goes out of fashion? Because it's starting to warm up. She looked at me, she goes, well, when you mean like in fashion, like you mean now or like decades ago, or do you mean like when you put it away, do you mean put it away or burn it? So she read me the riot act about wearing flannel. And then some guy who walked by me, another colleague of mine, a great guy who's taller than me, he's probably like 6'5", said, "No, no, no, it's totally in." She goes, "What does he know? He's European. Look at the way he's dressed." I love the personalities around the Gary Noel Network, the Progressive Radio Network. Isn't that great stuff? Anyway, so if you're Facebook Live, go on, vote yes or vote no for my flannel. I think it's totally in vogue. I will not wear one of those crazy beards that, you know, are very in vogue as well. But anyway, I'm wearing my flannel for a couple more days. Michelle Spitz is an incredible person. I got to know her when I met a mutual friend that I hadn't seen in probably about 15 years on a movie premiere for Real Abilities. Real Abilities showcases movies by persons by and or for or about persons with disabilities. So we met again with my friend Joanne Dean, who actually had a movie, I think, receive an award yesterday, which I'm going to have to get her on the phone and get her on the show to talk about. Anyway, I had the pleasure of meeting Michelle Spitz. Michelle Spitz is a dear friend of hers, became a dear friend of mine. She's a voiceover artist, philanthropist, and a disability advocate, and just a hell of a person. Michelle, great to see you.
Nice to see you.
How are you?
I'm wonderful.
New York City is a happier place now. You're back.
Oh, lots going on.
On your East Coast home.
Lots happening. So, good things, all good things.
A lot has happened in the last 2 years, but let's focus on the last, like, maybe 12, 15 months.
Yeah.
Talk about your most prized project that you're working on, because Michelle has a voice from God, and she's been lending her voice for voice narrations and voice descriptions for movies. Now, for people who are blind and visually impaired, why should they not experience the magic of cinema, right? Whether in a home, privacy of your own home, or in a theater that actually resembles your home because of the big lazy boy chair that you're sitting in now with milk duds that can't be, you know, unstuck. Anyway, so there is a service that's been around for 7-8 years?
Oh, no. This has been around for a long time, much longer than that.
Has it?
But it's been
much more popular.
Yeah, but it's much more prevalent now. But it's been there for a long time. Not a lot of people talked about it, but it's far more prevalent now. Now it's booming. It's exploding, actually.
So mainstream theaters have a way so blind or visually impaired people can wear headphones and hear the audio description and paint us a picture of a scene that you would possibly narrate.
Okay. So, for example, one of the most recent projects I'm very excited about is Pavarotti's new documentary.
Pavarotti.
Well, I say Pavarotti,
Pavarotti.
So everybody says it differently. God knows when I was trying to figure it out for the script, I was trying to decide which one I should choose. Anyhow, it's a wonderful documentary. It's a Ron Howard film. And in the case of this particular film, which is actually a really good example, I hired, because it's an Italian film with a lot of subtitles, and his wife, both his ex-wives, or one ex-wife, last wife deceased, and his daughters, of course, are speaking in Italian. So it's subtitled. Then there are images throughout the film of him singing, and then he's speaking in English, so on and so forth. There's a lot going on.
Big job to tackle.
Very big. Very big. So we hired two voiceover actors, one being a female and male, to voice the subtitles, which a blind individual obviously cannot see going across the screen, and they go into character. Then I narrate all the visual content in between.
So clear delineation about who's doing what.
That's exactly right. So an individual is not confused by the multiple voices. They're going to hear lots of people interviewed, because that's what the movie's about, a documentary. And then we're talking about different beautiful scenes, opera scenes, settings, and what have you. So I am basically narrating all the visuals and the natural pauses throughout the content of the film, and then the other individuals are reading the subtitles. Then, in addition to that, which isn't always the case with every film, but it's good to know, there's often text on screen. It could say Athens, the arena. A blind person wouldn't know that was there. They might hear me describe it, but I need to read text on screen. So that's how we do it. And we also describe beautiful logos for White Horse Pictures or Ron Howard's company or CBS Films. And then we go through the credits at the end. We add some credits in. And that's a fairly good example. But what's happening now is all the movie theaters, as of last July, are required and mandated to have headsets for the blind and captioning bars for the deaf.
Nationally across the states.
Yeah. So it's very exciting. Now, not all the media is currently up to that standard. The majority of the feature films are. A good portion of the independent films are now. I'd say maybe 60%, 70%. So when you go into the movie theaters, very typically now you'll see the closed captioning logo. You'll see the descriptive audio logo. It'll be available at the front desk, and it'll be in the newspapers. It'll be promoted on the website. And we have come a long way.
What does the logo look like?
AD logo has an A and a D and two half circle spheres on the right hand side.
Does it usually appear below the actual like rating of the movie, or is
no?
It
it's usually at what depends on where you're looking, but very typically it'll be next to the title.
Oh, great!
And so, and some people will use a descriptive a DA. They all do different things. In my world, it's audio description. If it is television, it's called video description because it's video content per se. But films are audio description in our world. But many people use different terms, but relatively all the same. But also something else very, very exciting, and not a lot of people know about it, is Hulu just started audio description for the first time. And they have 14 titles as of today of original content. So they have taken off essentially where Netflix did. And so Netflix was the premier provider for a long time. So Hulu is next in line. And Apple just released their content, their big platform of big competition in Netflix, original programming, other programming taking over, maybe some HBO programming, some CBS programming. They're going to be in 100 countries. And I'm assuming, and it's it would be a default if they – I mean, at default, it'll all be audio described because Apple's very
– Now, to get down to the technical aspect, a film has multiple tracks. You have the video portion.
That's right.
The film aspect, and then you have the audio tracks. So in essence, it's not a big undertaking for a major film company and or but for a smaller operation it is.
That's right.
But in terms of, it's not so much the actual physical part of doing it, it's all the text that has to be done, all the approvals and all the descriptions, so that the back end stuff, the action to get you into the studio, that's
right.
Where all the work is actually to do it, that's your art, and that's another aspect of it. But all the back end work I should say is the pricey part.
Yeah, and the, you know, the links in the chain, unfortunately, at times get broken, and this is still, you know, part of where we are in history, and hopefully in time that will change because it's a more universal subject. But that being said, yes, I receive a film, I receive the media from them. We then often ask for a transcript, which sort of breaks down some of the visuals and scenes in case we need clarification. We then hand it off to an audio describer who's a writer per se. It takes them about 10 hours to write a full-length film. They time code it. We take it back. We do a QC process. Quality control, to be sure that everything is lined up perfectly and time-coded and placed properly. I then go in the studio.
How long would that take, Michelle? Sorry for the interruption.
That's okay. I would say that takes a few hours. You know, it has to be very carefully time-coded. So by the time I go into the studio, there isn't any delay process. Then I go in and I record. It takes me about 2.5 to 3 hours to record a film. Then it goes back into the hands of the editor and the engineer. He then edits all of that so that it is perfectly in sync with everything they need. And then it's also then mixed into an audio file, which is something that would be on streaming or a DVD. That's different. That's where the media is then
merged.
The audio description is merged into the actual audio file as opposed to a separate file.
Sort of embedded.
Yeah, it's embedded. And then that has to be married and laid back to the picture. So that audio mix has to be laid back to the picture. That is the responsibility of the filmmaker or the distributor, whoever has taken this on. So essentially, the audio-only file belongs on a digital cinema package, which is what all the movie theaters use. And that's something they hear in their headset as a separate soundtrack. And then they'll hear the movie in the rest of their, you know, sort of their realm. And then when they're watching it at home, it'll be with open description. They don't have to wear a headset because it's already embedded. So it just becomes a natural process or a DVD. You just turn it on. You toggle it on.
Great overview, Michelle. Let's take this a step further. When you're actually in the cinema, mm-hmm. is that Bluetooth technology where the person who's wearing the headsets is getting that signal only?
I just know it's on one of the channels, and the channel is, I guess, synced into their headset. When you say Bluetooth, in terms of Bluetooth, I know that ActiveView uses a technology where their app senses the audio description, and so it picks it up from another source, and that's different.
Wireless, or are they plugged in?
Some are wireless, and some are plugged in. Some have a little, it looks like an old, forgot what you call, used to call them, Walkman.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And it's plugged into the Walkman, and you have the ability to adjust the volume. Some now are with no, they're wireless, they have nothing, and you're controlling it just on the earpieces.
Great. So it acts as a receiver.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Wow. It's come a long way, but there's a lot of work to be done in the back end, as you described, and it's fascinating. So for a smaller budget film, it can be a little bit daunting, but that's where you come in as well, because you're a woman of your word.
I try.
That's a great way you've couched your position as a disability advocate, because you've funded many films.
I have.
Out of the goodness of your heart. And what drove you to become so passionate about this endeavor?
Because initially, as a philanthropist, my particular goal was arts and, should I say, I want to say accessibility, but not in the terms of what we're talking about now, meaning that marginalized communities, seniors, veterans, homeless, AIDS, you know, sort of patients, things like this, and children, individuals that couldn't make their way to the arts for a number of reasons, whether it was financial or physical or what have you, I wanted to make it my business that they had a place to sit and enjoy the arts. So I had been doing that as a philanthropist for about 4 years. And then the concept of audio description, which I knew nothing about, came to my knowledge, and I was asked to participate. And then I realized that I could make an art form accessible with my voice. So it was the perfect, beautiful round sort of lineage of where this was going. And that became my passion. So it wasn't expected. And I've been doing it for 5.5 years, and I have funded over 55 – well, I voiced over 55 films. I've done museums. I've done a lot of promotional videos. And I have funded, I would say, 75% of all of them.
Outstanding. And it's a nice way to have reinvented yourself. This is not something you've been doing for your whole career.
Not at all.
No, but it's something that obviously you probably have been told throughout your years of possibly in the sales industry, in real estate, that, wow, you have good pipes. Hi, would you like to buy this? And then this is something that's morphed, you know, just seamlessly. And you've executed it and really have run with it. So kudos to you.
Yeah, I love it. I was in marketing for 25 years in real estate, and I had my degree was in broadcasting, and I had always really wanted to pursue voiceover work, and I really didn't have an opportunity to. I sort of just fell into real estate and marketing, and that's what happened. So I'm now 55. I started at 49. And so it's never too late find your calling. It's clearly my calling. It's the happiest time of my life.
Good for you. And the fact that we can also bring this technology to museums.
Yep.
Wow. Right here in New York City.
Yep. I did the Cooper Hewitt, the Smithsonian.
Fantastic. I mean, the fact that, I mean, it's hard for me. I'm visually impaired, but just to see read the descriptions on the walls, and the fonts have become bigger, but it's arduous. So to be able to slap on a pair of headphones and have the ease of the description just be enveloped in my world.
Right.
And now I cannot worry about having to concentrate on the text. Now I can just really take in everything else.
Yes. And for example, with the Cooper Hewitt, the Smithsonian, that was a unique exhibit. That was the senses. And that had to do with the senses, solution to the senses. It was very special. It ran for 6 months. And basically it had more than just an audio tour. It had tablets with visual content describing all the items on the tables, like a Braille watch, all sorts of things. And then it had visual video art in a movie theater in the corner of the museum. So I audio described all of the tablets as well as the museum in the corner and the audio tour. So and I funded that. That was the largest piece I did. And very exciting, the next one I'm working on, and I don't know what capacity I've decided to do yet, is the Motion Picture Academy Museum, which is opening up in L.A.
Fantastic.
In the fall.
Wow.
It's going to be 50,000 square feet. It'll have 2 theaters. It's extraordinary.
Long time in the works for this.
Long time in the works. Used to be the May Company, the department store. So it's a historical property. And it's going to be pretty exciting.
That is very exciting.
Yeah. So they're going to have an audio description tour in terms of just taking you around. And that's going to be narrated by an Academy talent. This will be the first time in history that an Academy talent will be doing audio description. So there'll be a tour for the sighted, for the non-sighted, and for the hearing impaired. I think they're going to be doing some sort of app with sign language. I don't think they've decided yet what they're doing.
Is there a vetting process? Are you in the running, Michelle?
Oh, no. I had already approached them as a philanthropist a year ago. I've been talking to them for a long time. So because I'm not an Academy talent, the Academy decided...
I would argue that.
Well, you're very kind. But they felt that all the rest of the for example, let's say the Marvel studio, that'll be a Marvel talent that will be audio describing that, not just for the sighted. Then the non-sighted, I don't know if it's going to be the same talent or a separate talent, but that's the Academy. So where I stand with them now is that I'm going to make a contribution no matter what. There will be film clips racing around the walls that will not be described by an Academy talent. I might decide to do those and produce them. And or I may decide to produce and hire and provide Braille maps for the museum. So I haven't decided. It's going to depend on what works best for them, what works best for me, and my budget. But I will be participating on some level for this community.
And either way, consumers will be served. That's the
only thing I'll do is to serve them. And Real Abilities opened in L.A., by the way. For the first time last October, I was part of it. We're going to be doing another Real Abilities in L.A. this year. I'll be part of that, and I'll be the accessibility specialist for all the screenings to be sure everything is accessible.
And Real Abilities is the film festival I mentioned a few minutes ago at the head of the show when Michelle joined us about film festival for persons and by persons with disabilities. Great documentaries, great feature films, etc. It's actually happening in New York in the next
right now? Opening night. Opening night, by the way, I just want to mention because it's a great film. Is called Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. It's a phenomenal film with a woman who's profiled her son, who is a musician and deaf, and her parents, who are both deaf. It's skipped generation. And it's beautiful. It's an HBO film. And this is very exciting, by the way. You'll be the first to hear. It will air next year at Beethoven's, I think, 250th anniversary.
Wow.
And Hulu has decided, not Hulu, excuse me, HBO has decided that they will take on audio description for the first time, and I think this will be the film. So I funded it. I sponsored it. I didn't voice it this year because I didn't have time. So I assigned the voiceover artist, but I sponsored and voiced it. So this is a big movement because HBO is behind Hulu. There will be a class action suit if Hulu doesn't step up. Pardon me, if HBO doesn't step up, which was the case with Netflix and Hulu. So this is extremely exciting because HBO has amazing content. Eventually Showtime.
But why is HBO so reluctant?
I think the technology, they're going to have to bring in the cost. Does Hulu pay for the original series like Netflix and create the audio description? Who's going to be the preferred vendors? What technology are we going to use? You know, it's daunting to them. So a lot of them are going to do original content. Whether or not they're going to take in additional content where the audio description exists and comes in like things that I do, independent films, because I typically do independent films because they can't afford to, and I do a lot of documentaries, is left to be seen. I really don't know. One other thing I want to mention, because it's New York-based. Sorry, I live in San Francisco. My mind's still there. There's another film. We'll see when it comes out. It's called Driven to Abstraction. It's a New York story film, and it uncovers...
Great title.
Yeah, it's a fabulous talent. And it uncovers the $80 million forgery scam that was at the Knoedler Gallery for the abstract art that was sold to some of the most extraordinarily well-known people in the world for an extraordinary amount of money. And it went on for 15 years, the fraudulent activity.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And it started in 1994 to 2008. And the filmmaker even went into the courtroom to see what was going on. And all three people involved in this situation settled. It's an interesting story. So we'll see where it ends up. I don't know where it's going to get its distribution.
Going back to the facility that's opening up in L.A., it would be interesting, and I would like to see voiceover artists who are actually for that discipline, a blind and visually impaired voiceover artist doing the audio description for a particular piece, because certainly in the hub of L.A.
That's right.
Where there's never enough representation.
That's right.
Of persons with disabilities. And then you have a split the hairs right there. Is the person playing the part really disabled, or are they actually acting as if they have a disability?
That's right. And Audio Eyes, by the way, in L.A., which is a great company. I started my career there.
Audio Eyes, E-Y-E-S?
Yeah. Great company. Rick Boggs is the proprietor. He's blind himself. Some of his engineers are blind. And Rick voices a lot of things. So do some of his engineers. The writers, of course, are not blind because they have to look at the material and write the scripts. But they do great work. At one time, I wanted to bring Audio Eyes in to the museum. But as I said, you know, they're looking at Academy talent. And so that would eliminate a number of people at this time. But that being said, you're correct. And I've spent a lot of time in L.A. and in New York, and I've sort of gone between coasts to see what's missing where. And I've made an enormous push in Hollywood to raise awareness in audio description. So I do panels all the time. I do public speaking all the time, and I am doing everything I can to make it a universal subject. It is still not a universal subject for filmmakers, distributors, post-production houses. So many people don't know it, and so many blind people don't even know it exists or don't have access to it. So it's still an unknown to so many people, but as many of us that are talking about it more and more, the more it's becoming obvious to the population. But we have a long way to go.
We do. We do. And also in the on the coattails of Europe, because Europe has been trailing this blaze.
That's right.
For, what, 10, 15 years
long
now?
Long time. UK is very good. Yeah. Australia, Canada is amazing. Germany does a fair amount. It's everywhere. But the UK, you know, these things are paid for in different ways in the UK, all the live arts, the opera and the ballet and things like that. And Broadway, those shows are often paid for by the charitable organizations. Whereas here in the States, a lot of the programming that's paid for, that's mandated by a certain amount of hours per broadcast, not the movies, is paid by the Department of Education with big grants they offer. So one is sort of education-based, one is charity-based, and depending on where you are, the funding is limited. So that's why a lot of what I've done has been geared towards funding that doesn't exist. We don't know one other person who's offering audio description grants. I'm the one. And I'm a small personally doing so much as I can.
Do you think our government should be subsidizing this, or something that the MPA Motion Picture Association should set a date by 2025? All films must be X, Y, and Z.
I think that no matter what, to
meet the needs,
for a mandate to exist where all movie theaters need to have the equipment, then that means to me that all content needs to be audio described.
Absolutely.
And captioned. So in my mind, I don't know if the day will ever come that I believe all content should be audio described and captioned. But that isn't necessarily a reality. But let's just say we have to look at the good side. The progress we've made is huge.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, in New York now, GallaPro, which is an app also, a headset that you're able to use, is available for a lot of your Broadway shows, and it has the captioning. And so now,
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it's real exciting. GallaPro is an Israeli company. And so it's also being used for your live dance performances, nonprofit theaters. It's costly. And that is pre-recorded. The syncing, you know, time issue, there's a lapse sometimes. Not ideal. But
it exists. That's
it
great.
Exists.
It's a great start.
And so it's a great start. So that's to say now that most of live performances, your museums, your movie theaters, your television, your streaming, your DVDs, your Blu-rays, we're moving in the right direction.
Okay, Michelle, here's a question from total far left field.
Okay.
What about porn?
That's already audio described.
It is?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And
okay,
fact, it's,
only have another minute. Remember. Tell me about this.
Well, it was a couple of years ago. There's one particular,
this
I'm not
is
sure. Yeah, I don't remember. I forgot what the company is, but yeah, one of them is.
Wow.
In fact, I knew somebody who did the voiceover.
Have you ever seen or heard the
description? No, I don't want to. Doesn't interest me.
Well, you know what? We have to service people.
No, that's true. But one of
sorry, don't read into
okay.
that.
No, that's okay. Somebody I know who was a consumer. Mm-hmm. I asked somebody.
Okay.
And he said it was vile. He said, first of all, it took away from the entire experience for him.
Well, first of all, listen to the music that they choose. The music alone is bad.
Do I have to talk about this?
No,
I won't even choose projects that are overly sexual or overly violent. I only check the beautiful things. No, but it exists. It exists. I don't know if it's still there, but a couple of years ago.
Well, I mean, the industry is one of the biggest industries out there.
Yeah.
Multi-billion-dollar industry.
That takes a certain somebody who wants to be doing that.
It does. It does, certainly. So let's get back to the decency of the world. Your website, awomanofherword.com?
Womanofherword.com.
And why a woman of her word?
Because I am a woman of her word. It's a double entendre. I stand by my word. I speak the words. I live the words. I breathe the words.
And thank you for sharing those words.
Thank you.
You're a pleasure. Keep up the incredible work.
Thank you so much.
That you're serving to so many people. And I will do my best to communicate everything you're doing for organizations like AFB, American Federation for the Blind, NFB, National Federation for the Blind. Mm-hmm. So all these organizations know about this so they can disseminate this information to their consumers. It's vital.
Yep. They know about me too. Already. I'm already working with them too.
Michelle, enjoy. Let's do lunch very soon, like in the next 35 minutes.
Have a great day.
My name is Mark Frow. The show is Insight. I welcome to the show Lauren Urberniak. She's from the NRDC, the National Resource Defense Council. We're going to be talking about the Department of Energy. They're intent on rolling back energy efficiency standards for the common light bulb. Now, if you think about this, we've grown leaps and bounds in the last, I'd say, 10 or years on making the traditional light bulb disappear, and then that could change. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you? Are you in the D.C. area?
I am, yes.
How are the cherry blossoms?
Beautiful. I think we have a 65-degree day today.
So oh, fantastic.
Pretty nice here. Not so bad.
I can't wait to get down there in about 2 weeks to see them. Hopefully they haven't totally disappeared in 2 weeks. So talk about this, because this is just a disaster in the works. Of course, we don't think it's a huge surprise, considering the person who is our chief. But this is something that just doesn't make any sense, because look how far and how much ground we've gained in the last 5-10 years with CFL bulbs and now with LED bulbs. I mean, the progress is huge.
Absolutely. And you raise a really good point that we've come really far. And just to give you a little bit of history, so back in about 2007, so actually under the George W. Bush administration, a Republican administration, there was bipartisan legislation that was put in place to address light bulbs. Light bulb technology up until that point really had not changed for 140 years since they were originally invented. That incandescent technology was the same. So that legislation put in place this transition that would take place in two parts. The first part happened back in 2012. That was where we saw an uptick in the availability of CFL bulbs and starting to get into LED bulbs. And the second phase of that is scheduled to take effect on January 1st, 2020. And it really just continues the progress, puts in place just this second part of a law that has been on the books since 2007. And what the Trump administration is trying to do, they're trying to stop that second phase. It just doesn't make any sense. These bulbs are widely available. The fact that manufacturers have been planning for this since 2007 means that costs have already come down. The bulbs are, they perform great.
Absolutely.
And LED technology is even leaps and bounds better than CFLs. So it just doesn't make any sense, and it'll cost consumers, we're estimating about $12 billion a year in additional energy costs. That's real money.
Lauren, you made very valid points there, and I wanted to underscore one thing, is that the price point, and ahead of the show, I'm not sure if you were listening, was kind of like a sticker shock in the beginning, 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now it's like, okay, well, this makes sense. It's an investment. Yeah, I can see this. You don't see it come off your electric bill, but you can do the math, et cetera, because the math is done for you. Not that I go home and do the math on my kitchen counter. It's done right for you on the packaging. And aesthetically, it's grown leaps and bounds, and it's warm. It does the job, and you have choices. The fact that we can actually put our minds around or heads around this to go backward 10 years and in technology, it just is unfathomable. And it's just a serious misappropriation of giving certainly the fossil fuel people industry, more legitimacy, which, doesn't happen. And a quick question, Lauren, wasn't the last incandescent bulb factory, was it run by GE? Wasn't that closed about a year or two ago?
So most incandescents are made outside of the U.S. So most of those, the incandescent and even the halogen bulbs, which are slightly more efficient than incandescents, but still not nearly as good or cost effective as a CFL or LED, most of them are made overseas anyway. So there's lots more jobs in the U.S. related to LED bulbs. One of the top leading manufacturers of LED bulbs, their headquarters is in North Carolina. They employ a couple thousand people. So we're talking about technological innovations and the jobs that come with those, rather than the manufacturing jobs for these cheaper, less efficient bulbs that are generally overseas.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, is it illegal? Is there a mandate that incandescent bulbs cannot be manufactured in the States?
Well, what we're talking about here, what we're talking about with these standards for how much energy a bulb uses, like I was saying, there's two different phases. So the everyday bulbs that we're talking about, the ones that go into any kind of lamp that are kind of a pear shape, Those are already meeting a standard. So those are generally not widely available. But the standard that we're talking about today is the second phase of that standard, which would apply to more specialty type bulbs, like bulbs that you would put in a candelabra or a chandelier, or the bulbs that would go into if you have can lights or something like that in
Sure.
your kitchen.
Which are becoming more available, certainly in the last year and a half, because Ivory replaced all those.
They are certainly more available, but they're not available everywhere. And that's what a standard, that's really the beauty of a standard, is that if you were to go into a dollar store, or if you were to go into, you know, not everybody has access to a Home Depot or a Lowe's with hundreds of options. And a standard ensures that even if you go into a grocery store or somewhere that doesn't have as much of a stock, that you're not going to be stuck with these bulbs that are going to cost you so much more over their lifetime. Because not only do they use more energy, they also don't last that long. So compared to when we're talking about an LED bulb that lasts 10 to 25 years, and right now maybe a dollar or two more expensive, but in some cases, they're about equivalent to what you can find for a normal a bulb that meets the minimum standard. So certainly what standards do is they make sure they raise the bar for everyone and ensure that everyone has access, and also tend to bring prices down over time because it really helps to change the market.
Absolutely does. And the stat that's pretty alarming is by 2025, Trump's rollback of light bulb efficiency standards will result in the same carbon pollution as 7 million cars. So please go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's about equivalent to 25 power plants, which is all of the power that's used by New Jersey and Pennsylvania combined. So we're talking about big numbers here.
Very big numbers. So what can our listeners do, Lauren?
We have a great website that has some more information. It's nrdc.org/protect efficiency. And the reason that this is so timely is that this is an active proposal by the Trump administration, and it's open for comment right now. So listeners can go onto that site, nrdc.org/protect efficiency, to sign a petition to tell the Trump administration to stop messing with standards that make sense. There's this light bulb standard, but they're also trying to slow down the overall program that sets standards for things like refrigerators and dishwashers and heating and cooling equipment that have saved literally trillions of dollars over the past 30 years. So these programs make sense, and the public has benefited immensely, and we'd love to hear additional voices.
How much momentum does this have, Lauren, in terms of rolling back the actual cause here and platform?
You know, it's always a little hard to say, given this administration. It seems to us like they're inclined to do something, and the more voices that we have telling them that this is not acceptable, the better. But I wouldn't be surprised if this eventually ends up in court.
Which a lot of his items do.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's just hard to see and understand when a giant movement, when you have to change someone's habit, that is a gargantuan undertaking on a macro national level. And I think, is it fair to say, Lauren, that we have succeeded in doing so?
I think it's fair to say that standards for equipment and appliances really make it so that people don't have to change their habits, and they reap the energy savings, they reap the benefits in technology.
True.
And they don't have to really even do anything different other than choose an appliance that meets their needs, because they meet a minimum level of energy efficiency. And that's a great thing. And that's
true.
Something
well said.
That should continue. And it's really under attack right now by this administration, and these standards are cost effective. They've been supported in a bipartisan fashion. Consumers either generally like them or don't even know about them because their appliances and equipment just work so well, they just use less energy. So it's really a no-brainer, and it's really one that we'd love your listeners to learn more about.
Absolutely. And what is Trump's administration claim or foothold by saying this is why it should be done, rolled back?
They have been hearing from some manufacturers who think that the standard is not necessary are saying that, you know, the market can take care of this on their own. And honestly, ironically, pointing to the fact that the market has shifted so dramatically and it's to LED or CFL bulbs. But one of the reasons why that's happened is because there's been a standard in place. Hmm. So if that 2007 law wasn't in place, I think we'd see a very different market for LEDs. And while the market can take care of a lot, it can't overcome some of the failures that
absolutely
consumers don't always know what they're looking for.
Lauren, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Lauren Urbaniak from NRDC. We're going to have a link on my page, on the inside page, to the page on the NRDC website so listeners can go and be proactive and do what they need to do. Thank you so much for all the incredible work NRDC does, and first and foremost, for heading this initiative on straight and fast forward, because this has to be something that cannot pass. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you very much for having me.
My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much to Lauren Urbaniak and also Michelle Spitz for incredible insight. For audio description, of course, thanks to the fine folks here at the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Noah's next. If you want me to speak at your school or college or corporation, information is coming up. My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great day.
Insight with Mark Farrell. Check out this and all Insight shows on the Insight page at PRN.FM. PRN.FM. Have Mark speak at your company, your kid's school or college. Mark speaks on critical topics that affect kids and adults everywhere, from anti-bullying, mental health, drugs, and alcohol to overcoming adversity. Visit MarkFarrellMotivation.com for more info. Insight, Thursday mornings at 11.